Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for clicking on the latest in-depth interview podcast here at peterbcollins.com. Today, it's the return of Frances Moore LePay. Frankie, as she is known to her friends and family. Author of a couple of dozen books, starting with The Diet for a Small Planet. She's an activist for democracy. And I find her quite inspiring. Today, we give advice to Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders on how to avoid that socialism trap while talking about the need to reform capitalism and regulate it. And we talk about the growing divide between the wealthy and the rest of us in this country and what it means for our political system. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with subscriptions, including Jason Ferguson, Janet Price, Peter J. Hoffmeister, and Wendy Gebauer. They kick in $5 or $10 a month, and you're saying, I could do that? If so, visit peterbcollins.com. Click on Menu, click on Become a Subscriber. When you're on the sign-up page, it's easy to choose a level of support that's comfortable for you and your budget. My thanks to Shuggie Otis for our intro music today, and I thank you for listening. Today on the Peter B. Collins Podcast, Frances Moore LePay returns. She's a prolific author. More than 24 books by my count, starting with Diet for a Small Planet way back in the 1970s, and most recently with Adam Eichen, the inspiring young activist. She wrote Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Frances Moore LePay goes by the nickname Frankie, and Frankie is in the Bay Area, where she just received an honorary degree from the University of San Francisco at their commencement exercises over this past weekend. And it's a welcome back for Frankie, who spent a lot of time here raising two kids in Berkeley back in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s. Frankie, it's always a pleasure to visit with you.
Thank you, Peter. Very, very mutual feeling.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about, and I want to get you to expand. You're, as I mentioned, a prolific writer, and if people go to your website at smallplanet.org, that's the organization that you run out of Cambridge, Massachusetts, they can find a range of commentaries that you have published recently and going back a few years. And I want to start with this one where you addressed your senator in Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, who, of course, is campaigning for president, and she's running a richly detailed policy-based campaign, the kind of thing that Frankie kind of just sinks her teeth into, from what I can tell. But you have some comments about her recent remark where she said, I am a capitalist, and you would like her to define that in a little different manner.
I would, because to most people, I'm a capitalist means that your sense of our economy and what works is limited to one approach, and that is means of production controlled by private individuals who, you know, profit from that capital investment. And it ignores the fact that a market economy that is thriving is what most people want. And it has many dimensions that are very effective today that are not owned by capital. And what I'm saying is that I've been so excited about the growth of the cooperative movement. And in many communities across the country, for example, public utilities are very effective, and they actually can be more cost efficient than privately held utilities. So there are many ways to organize a market economy that works for all of us and not dependent just on ownership by private capital, which leads to the extreme concentration of control that we have today, where in 12 industries, just two corporations control half or more of the market. Mm-hmm. So I just want to, Elizabeth, to lead us into this focus on a functional, accountable market economy and break away from this debate about capitalism.
Well, and I understand what is going through her mind when she says that. We have the dear tweeter who attacks Bernie Sanders on a regular basis as some kind of a dyed-in-the-wool socialist who will wreck the economic system of the United States with giveaways that, you know, that it's cartoonish the way they describe socialism, and they use it to defend the indefensible aspects of extreme capitalism. And we are seeing this continuation of the amass of wealth and income at the top 1 and 2% of our population at the expense of the rest of us. And we also have a compliant corporate media that celebrates wealth and, talks about people who have nothing to, no claim to fame except that they happen to have money that buys them celebrity. And we have a culture that really emphasizes many of the wrong elements of our system.
Exactly. And what I think Elizabeth and Bernie can do is to broaden people's understanding that a functional market and capitalism are not synonymous, and that we don't have to choose between socialism in its caricature or its cartoonish, state control of everything. We don't have to choose between that or capitalism as we know it, that I believe in the possibility of a truly democratic economy that has many, as I was alluding to before, many elements, many ways to structure with cooperatives, with community-owned businesses, what are called benefit corporations and B corporations that have a broader agenda than just accumulating capital to capital owners. So I want Elizabeth and Bernie to really break free from that either socialism or capitalism and talk about what does a democratic market economy look like.
And I've heard Senator Sanders, fumble this question. He went on Fox News, and by the way, I believe that Warren is wrong to avoid Fox News. There are people who can be reached by Democrats who are watching that propaganda channel. And I think that overall, Bernie acquitted himself pretty well in a town hall meeting a couple of months ago. But when a young person asked him about capitalism and socialism, I don't think he gave a very good answer. And I wanted to coach him on that and say, listen, Senator, you need to talk about socialist ideas as the antidote to the evils of extreme capitalism. And when you introduce Medicare for All as a topic, that is the perfect example of offsetting the obviously failed effort to deliver health care through a for-profit system. And,
exactly.
These are not scary terms, but I believe that if Senator Sanders had better answers when he's asked about socialism, it might limit Elizabeth Warren's need to distance herself from the evils of socialism. You know, they get compared to Maduro in Venezuela, and, that's a false rap to begin with.
Yeah, no, this duality is just a trap. And I want us all to break free of it. And I'm open. I was recommending in my piece to Elizabeth Warren and others to use the term democratic market economy to make sure, because I think when people hear socialism, they think that means you are against the market economy. But actually, a market economy cannot work, as we see now, because of the extreme concentration. It cannot function without rules that we as a community set to keep it fair and open and competitive. What happens is that it ruins, left to its own devices, a market will kill the very virtues that it was supposed to be there to to embody that is competition, openness, and transparency, and information about products. That's the whole assumption of what a market needs. And when it's highly concentrated, as I just said, you know, that all those virtues are lost. So I think that the language is there. And I personally, you know, I have a love affair with the term democracy. Mm-hmm. I think it should be my middle name now. I really think we should use that when we are talking about the vision that we have for our country, including the economic aspects of our society, not just the political. Because I honestly, as you know, as Louis Brandeis is often credited with saying, he never said these exact words, but it was the intent, that you can have wealth in the hands of a few, or you can have democracy, but you cannot have both. That was what the Supreme Court justice reminded us. And so I think we have to see this connection between political democracy and economic democracy.
And I give Elizabeth Warren a lot of credit for her work as a professor, for her work as the director who set up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau during the Obama administration. And I don't think she needs to feel defensive about her work in trying to properly regulate capitalism. And,
exactly.
You know, this is a defensive remark in my view.
It is. And that's a great point to bring up, because what that agency does is exactly what the market needs.
Well,
I call
it's
values.
It's pardon me, Frankie. It's what it did before Mick Mulvaney got there. I think we do need to put it in the past tense, at least
you.
For now.
Thank you. Correction. Correct. Fact check there. Thank you. But the spirit of it, the initiating spirit, because she herself, you know, was that's how she. Her claim to fame, rightly, beginning her writing about the causes of bankruptcy and how fraudulent credit card companies and others were in trapping people into, to debt they could not support and leading to bankruptcy. So I really think that she's got it in her to find to break out of defense mode and into this vision of an economy that can work for all of us.
And I credit her with not attacking Joe Biden. That's how Biden supporters view it. But as soon as he formally announced for president, she was right there saying, look, this is the guy who helped the credit card companies pass this really egregious bankruptcy law that traps people from those with student debt to those with unexpected health expenses into really onerous bankruptcies, while we see corporations, including you mentioned utilities a few minutes back, Frankie, and we've got this rogue utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, which has committed criminal negligence. It's been found to be a criminal corporation by federal courts. It now is, protected by the bankruptcy laws. And some of the people who lost their homes and property to wildfires in 2017 and 2018 will wait for years to get their due because this company will use the bankruptcy laws in ways that are not available to average citizens.
Wow. Well, yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. I had just read recently about Joe Biden's record on that, and I had not remembered it. So I'm glad you're bringing it up now.
Well, and Senator Warren, this is where I think she's very effective. She's not a shin kicker. She is somebody who is very direct on policy issues. She doesn't personalize it, but she makes very clear that Senator Biden, Vice President Biden, has promoted a lot of bad economic policies over his lengthy political career. And this is the kind of honest debate and differentiation that we need in this extremely crowded Democratic primary this cycle.
Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about what you call the antidotes to extreme capitalism. And these are worker-owned entities, and you're a big fan of cooperatives. For people who've never touched one, I know there's the Coop at Harvard.
And yes.
There are many other examples that maybe get lost because they're just out there in plain sight. But give us a sense of the economic power of organizations that are not based on corporate capitalism.
Well, one of the most stunning statistics worldwide that I think would surprise most people is that cooperatives, that is owned by their members, either their workers or consumers, their products, their sales come to about $3 trillion worldwide. And so that's a sum that's equal to the total equity ownership of the combined global giants of Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook. And they employ 10% of the officially employed people in the world. And I think that's significant given that they are given so little credit. And my own personal love affair, I guess I can call it, with cooperatives and what they can do, started in the late 80s for me when I was in rural Wisconsin and happened to have an evening with some kind of ragtag farmers who were, their friends and neighbors were going out of business. There was suicide in the late 80s and the dairy farmers, and they said, well, maybe we should start a co-op. And I thought, how sweet that they could help their neighbors and perhaps stay in business in Western Wisconsin. And today this is a billion-dollar business. I laugh at myself at Ye of Little Faith because I'm talking about Organic Valley that now represents over 1,000 farmers all around the country. It's a, as I say, a billion-dollar business. And it's really a significant player in the organic world and just started by a handful of people. And the demand now is so great for organic products that they can't even, you know, they have to turn away some farmers in the short term while they prepare to grow. So I want to point out that another example of a cooperative that probably most people have never heard of, I interviewed in the 90s a new cooperative of home healthcare workers in the Bronx in New York that had been founded by some ex-welfare recipients who wanted better lives, and they wanted to do home health care work, but it was such arduous work. They decided to join and create a cooperative, and it is now the largest worker cooperative in the United States, 2,000 workers, and their pay, their working conditions are well above the industry standard, and the quality of care is setting the industry standard. This is called Cooperative Home Care Associates. So these are just two stories that help explain why I sense so much potential for this structure of business organization.
And Frankie, I recall it was kind of a flavor back in the 1980s, a form of organization called ESOP, Employee Stock Ownership Plan. Is that still alive and functioning in some sectors? Do you know?
It is. It is. In fact, a critic wrote to me about that piece where I talk about cooperatives and B corporations and benefit corporations, asking me, why didn't you include ESOPs, employee stock ownership? So I wrote back and said, good point, good criticism. But I haven't, I know they, yes, are very much alive. I don't. I know that they help to spread the wealth in a way that just a regular corporate structure does not, in fact, concentrates wealth. So I know that there are real pluses, and I assume it varies very, very much depending on the company involved. But thank you for reminding me. And do you know more than that? About ESOPs?
I just recall they were kind of introduced as a legal novelty back in the 1980s, and some people tried them, and I hadn't heard much in recent years.
That's true.
I'm sure there's some successful examples out there, and if listeners want to send me a note and tell us about one, feel free to drop me a line, peter@peterbcollins.com. And Frankie, another column that you wrote in May of this year is stunning in its impact. And you present a graph that is not new. It was published back in 2006 or 2007. And it shows the long arc of income and income distribution in the post-war period. So starting in 1947 and up through the mid-70s, the distribution of income growth was fairly equal across the wealth groups, but the poorest people did enjoy the largest gains in income. But starting in the mid-70s, the Nixon into Reagan period, we see that the poorest or the lowest income groups have had the lowest growth in income, and the wealthiest groups have had the highest growth in income. And I know that figures in the post-recession period, after the 2008 Wall Street meltdown, show that the, and this is something that Sanders echoed heavily in 2016, that the recovery went mostly to the top people who already had high incomes and substantial wealth. And this disparity is driving much of the unrest and anger that I see in the country today.
Yes, this bar chart just blows my mind, because the dramatic difference, I think of it as my generation and my children's generation. You know, I was born in the 40s, my children in the early 70s, and different worlds. I mean, when you say that in my generation, from the 40s to the 70s, that the poor gained the most, that's true. But I just want to emphasize also, that's dramatic difference than today. But also what's so dramatic is that virtually it was everybody doubled their real family income, you know, adjusted for inflation, doubled virtually, and the poorest gained the most. So then you see this side, this next bar chart of my children's generation, that it's not just that the richest gained the most, as you say, but virtually nobody else gained. I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but certainly the poorest did not. So the weight, the strong weight was at the very highest 20% of the population gained by far the most. And as you say, if that chart were brought up to today, it would be literally off that chart that was drawn for this blog that I wrote. So yes, I wrote that, Peter, because I want people to hold that in their minds, that we do not have to live the way that we are now, and that a period when students weren't strapped with debt, my parents were, you know, modest income, middle class, and I had no student debt, you know, that we don't have to live with this reality today of the incredible on the edge. I'm sure you've seen these same statistics, that huge portion of Americans don't even have a $400, $500 savings to get them through a crisis.
Over 38% of Americans have less than $500 in the bank.
Thank you. Yes. So I just want people to look at that and let it sink in, that just in my lifetime, there has been this enormous, enormous shift. And I underscore, as you know, Peter, that my theory of social change is very much about the theory of ideas, and that they who tell the story rule the world. And the story of how our society works and what makes it work, that has changed so radically than from when I was a young person. We were then with the idea, I was part of the War on Poverty. That was my first job, as organizing for the War on Poverty. And we had the strong belief that we all gain together, that government is to help us all move forward together. And that story was very systematically rewritten starting in the 1970s. So I just want to underscore the power of ideas. It's not some automatic economic thing that's happened to us.
Yeah.
It is that we've fallen for a very false story.
Frankie, I just want to share, recently I spent a week in New York City, and I love going there. It's always a great experience. But a couple of things stand out. One is we visited this new development called Hudson Yards. and it's gleaming skyscraper towers that go up, and this huge shopping mall with all of the high-end retailers, you know, Rolex and Cartier and things that I could never afford. And I'm not a pauper, okay? And I looked at this, and I know that this development received massive subsidies from the city and state of New York. We're told that the subsidies were a multiple of what was offered to Amazon to locate its second headquarters in Long Island City. And when I went there, there is nothing for the New York taxpayer who is footing the bill for the corporate welfare that built this gleaming new set of buildings along the west side of New York. And Bill de Blasio, the mayor, takes credit for Hudson Yards, and he's running for president to represent the working people. And I just found a little disconnect there.
Well, you have brought us right into the next thing I so hoped we could talk about, and that is the connection between economics and politics and the lack of political democracy accountable to the people, which is what democracy should mean. And so I'm very happy to focus right there, because how is that possible, that what you describe, how completely anti-democratic that is, that the taxpayers are subsidizing the wealthiest. And so I wanted to mention, to make sure that this got on our table today, is a piece of legislation, H.R. 1, it is called, For the People Act. By the leader in this has been John Sarbanes of Maryland, a big hero of mine. So what that deal, that dramatic example in the state level represents, is what we also have seen at the national level, is the powerful influence of the most wealthy. Like 0.5% of Americans contributed 2/3 of the money spent in the in 2016, for example. So it is really an extreme situation. And this piece of legislation being introduced is one that takes on proven reforms to reduce, if not eliminate, the overbearing power of money in politics. And it also addresses transparency and voting rights, protecting against voter suppression, which has been so significant, and to make it easier for all of us to be participating voters. So I just want to underscore that one of the things that keeps me alive right now, keeps me fired up, is that there is a growing national and state and citywide, what I call, and Adam Eichen, my co-author of Daring Democracy, and I call, the democracy movement. And it is alive, and it is, I can go on and on about it, but I just wanted to put that there on the table as a direct response to this terrible example of private influence over public purse.
And the other snapshot from my visit to New York, Kathy and I love to look at art, and we went to the Met and MoMA and the Whitney, and we happened to be walking by Christie's auction house, and so we just walked through the door. And in this special kind of altar-like section was the display of Jeff Koons' rabbit. And the following day, it sold for $91 million. Now, Frankie, I spent a couple of minutes in that room with the rabbit, okay? And it's an attractive piece of art. I can't imagine that, you know, when Jeff Koons originally sold it, it was more than, say, $500,000. And to see someone who has loose change of $91 million, and it wasn't Steve Mnuchin's dad, he's just the art dealer representing a client who so far has not been identified. But when I first heard that it was Mnuchin who had bought it, I thought, wow, you know, this is money that came from foreclosures that were out of the IndyMac Bank that Steve Mnuchin and his buddies took over at the bottom of the trough of the 2008 recession. And so my immediate connection, which was false, I want to clarify, was that, you know, it was money extracted from foreclosures that was used to pay top dollar for this inanimate object that will not feed a human being, provide shelter, or, you know, have any use except some rich guy who can look at it and say, I've got it and nobody else does. What's your reaction to that? I realize it's not a policy point, but it is just the wretched excess that we see celebrated in America today as people are in tents camped around the corner from Christie's Auction House in New York.
Yeah. Boy, you've got some great stories to tell. And they are exactly the stories that I believe and I fear make Americans feel powerless, just disgusted, angry, and just wanting to throw bricks, literally or figuratively. And so that's why I want to come back to the fact that while it hasn't really made the headlines yet, that there is now what Adam and I call this movement of movements. And this is historic, Peter. This is really, I think, historic, where across all the different issue areas that I'm aware of, environment, race, poverty, you name it, economic injustice, everything, that across these areas that people are coming together and saying, we cannot address our issue unless we come together for democracy. That the stories you've told us are stories that so embody the extreme concentration of wealth that then has its way that infects and distorts our political decision-making against the interest of most of us. And I think despair may be our worst enemy right now. So I just want to underscore, for example, in the midterms, how many Americans were aware that just this last November that there were maybe, you know, there were what? There were nine states that passed significant reforms, everything from automatic voter registration in Nevada, for example, to Michigan that passed a
redistricting commission.
Thank you.
Citizens redistricting.
Because of. And I'm sure you know this story, and you should interview her, if I may boldly recommend your guest. But Katie Fahey was 25 when she posted on Facebook that she was disgusted by the effect of gerrymandering in Michigan. And she got 70 volunteers, and within a no time, in terms of how long these things usually take, she got the signatures to put it on the ballot. And now they are moving for. They passed with a great majority. They passed a initiative to make Michigan a state with an independent redistricting commission so that they can get rid of the effect of gerrymandering. So I think that as more and more Americans are aware that there is this democracy movement calling, and no matter where you live, there are people like Katie Fahey to inspire you and to connect with, that we can realize that this is an extreme aberration that cannot work. And certainly one of the theme songs of my life right now, because I'm starting a new book that ties in everything we're talking about with taking on the climate change challenge, that we cannot address climate change if indeed we don't have a democracy answering to us or an economic system that we can lead toward the solutions to climate change, because there are already, you know, several million jobs in just in clean energy efficiency moves itself. And so there's so much potential here. And I just want to really underscore how much is happening. And I wish I could say that it's available right now when I'm saying this, but within the next 2 months, we will have an exciting website called democracymovement.us. Mm-hmm. Democracymovement.us. If you out there would write that down and remember to look for it, because there you can see this great emergence and great energy.
I just wrote it down, and I will include it in the show file for this podcast so people can reference it going forward. And Frankie, tell me your thoughts about the Green New Deal and the way it has been, in many respects, mischaracterized. But I do embrace the broader agenda of trying to use the call to action for climate change to address other problems in our governance system. And ultimately, I don't think we will succeed or prevail in addressing climate warming and its attendant impacts if we don't really drastically reform our system. And once again, it is capital and the capitalists who really stand in the way.
Exactly. I mean, I'm impressed that 80% of us want the government to act on climate change, but three quarters of us have been influenced to believe that we can't afford it, that they're really worried about the cost. And I want to directly counter that, that the cost of inaction, first of all, is vastly greater and going to be that increasingly greater than the cost of action. And that there's so many places that we can access. Yes, it is costly. It could be 2-3% of our GDP, but we've done it in the past, say with the New Deal. We've invested that kind of energy and resource into it. But the great thing is that because, say, our tax system is now broken, because so many people who should do not pay taxes. I don't know if you saw that recently where many top corporations pay zero in taxes.
Oh, I remember. I remember Leona Helmsley, Frankie. Taxes.
Oh, gosh.
Taxes are for the little people.
Right. Right. And just, I'm looking at my cheat sheet here. That 322 of the Fortune 500 countries held 2.6 trillion in offshore wealth, and they avoid $767 billion in repatriation in taxes. So that, can you imagine if we had even half of that, a third of that, to use to invest in clean energy and to invest in training people for, say, energy efficiency work in buildings? There's so many ways, and these are much healthier jobs than many current jobs. And I know that the pay level in clean energy jobs is significantly above the, you know, the median. And so there's everything to like about this. And we should make these changes in the way our taxes are paid in any case, right? And you know what we're doing? Instead, we are defunding the IRS. I just learned that the staff, the auditors of the IRS are down to the level the cutback has been to what they had in the 1950s. It's really shocking. So I really want to underscore to our listeners that actually, I believe that the climate crisis can be this opportunity to do these really good things for ourselves that have to be done in any case, economic and politically, making these kinds of changes, making these fairness changes and good job creation and infrastructure. We've been told for decades that our infrastructure is dangerously underfunded. So all of that is a plus.
Well, and Frankie, I know Trump is just really chomping at the bit to build him some wall. But we need seawalls. We don't need a southern border wall. And Miami is facing inundation. There are parts of San Francisco Bay, Manhattan. There are, you know, low-lying areas, low-altitude levels all around this nation. And to imagine that we're going to just squander billions of dollars on a meaningless wall on the southern border when we have these dramatic infrastructure needs, both repairing crumbling stuff and retrofitting to make, you know, reasonable adjustments in the face of sea level rise and other factors. And we're seeing this held back by his Twitter base, which is a minority of Americans. But it paces or it parallels what corporate America wants to do, which is just get to the next quarterly profit statement and distribute, bonuses to executives. And I feel that we're facing two forms of acceleration. One is that I recently interviewed climate scientist Guy McPherson, and he acknowledges that his predictions are at the extreme. But I think we need to listen to the worst-case scenario and factor it in. And Guy McPherson says that he fears that humans will face extinction as soon as 2030 on this planet. And everybody, including Guy McPherson, hopes that he's wrong. But I think we have to pay attention and not just bury our heads and say, oh, it's all going to work out okay. The other side of this is the incredible financial pressure on the insurance companies who carry homeowners policies here in California. In 2 years in a row, the insurers have lost over $12 billion. And wow. I believe that there may actually be a beneficial influence from that sector of capitalism saying, hey, time out here. We have got to address these issues or we're not going to be able to write insurance. And the economy in certain respects could collapse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad that you are putting out these most frightening statistics. And I also want to underscore the hope that I get very personally from the awakening of young people and their leadership. I went to a rally a few weeks ago in Boston, and it wasn't even a very accessible location. And there were 1,400 people, standing room only, across every generation there, listening and cheering their leadership on this and focusing on the Green New Deal and how we must step forward and actually work out the policy implications, because the Green New Deal now is really a vision statement, and we have to support and press whoever's listening to this to contact their legislators. Our senator in Massachusetts, Ed Markey, of course, is one of the leaders. He spoke that night, but it was mainly young people. And people were jumping out of their chairs with enthusiasm. So I think that now is the moment to really encourage, and I would say financially support, if we can, groups like Sunrise Movement, young people to show if we can't get out there with them. But I encourage all of us to do what we have not done before. And this is kind of the theme of my life these days is that courage, that maybe humans are good enough, and what we need to work on now is our courage, that goodness is not good enough, and that means doing what we thought we could not do. And if that means standing up literally with the Sunrise Movement, let's do that.
And Frankie, you gave a talk at the University of San Francisco commencement this past weekend, and I did deep research. I looked you up on Wikipedia, and apparently this is your 19th honorary college degree. So tell us what the honor was about and what it means to you, and then share a little bit about what you told the graduates in this speech at their commencement.
Well, it was very humbling. I felt so honored, and I was so impressed by this university. It is the third most diverse university in America. And I certainly sensed that as I was sitting on the stage and the graduates passed in front of me. And I was just so taken with the value structure. I have a bag actually next to me in this moment that they gave me. The tagline of the University of San Francisco is, change the world from here. Hmm. Change the world from here. So I had my moments to try to capture. I told them all my life lessons in a few minutes. And I stressed what I was beginning there to speak about, Peter, that I told them the path of my life was discovering my questions, which was beginning in 1970s, in 1969, asking, why are people hungry in the world? Is it true that we've run out of food? And I let myself listened to my questions, and that's when my life started finding traction. And I led myself to the question, then behind that question, that, wait a minute, it's not scarcity. then what is it? Why are we creating a world together that we as individuals would never choose, because nobody gets up and says, yes, I want another child to die of hunger today. Mm-hmm. So that message of trust your questions and follow them into the unknown. And yes, the unknown is scary. So part of my speech was exactly on this theme of rethinking fear. I wrote a little book with a young person many years ago called, it's called You Have the Power, because the publisher wouldn't let us put fear in the title. They were afraid Americans were too afraid to buy a book about fear. The subtitle is Choosing Courage in a Culture of Fear. But the idea of my talk that I tried to underscore is that the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world, because with every act we take or don't take, we are changing the world. And so if we take the trust our questions and where they lead us into the unknown and learn to find our voice, it can be frightening. And so I gave them one of my cheesy gimmicks is when I'm terrified of humiliation or fumbling or sounding silly, or not being able to walk 100 miles, which I didn't know if I could do a few years ago, but I did, that my heart starts pounding wildly. And so I said, hey, we can reframe that as our inner applause that is cheering us on. It's not a sign that we're in danger, that we can turn that around. And so it was that kind of talk of really embracing fear and using it as energy, not as a stop sign. And I think that's where we are in our culture right now. If we let fear of climate catastrophe, fear of concentrated wealth being unmovable, then we are really going to be miserable, all of us, and it need not be. And so this democracy movement, I think, for me, it embodies, it includes, embody, embraces, it welcomes people who are willing to walk into the unknown together. And that is the brilliance of it. It is, when I walked, my life was changed by the walk in 2016 from Philadelphia to Washington, and perhaps the largest sit-in on the Capitol steps for democracy reforms. That's what changed me and made me feel more that I could do more. And so that was my message to the young people.
Well, Frankie, thank you for sharing that. Let me say that my perception of you is of someone who is virtually fearless, and you have taken on big issues and powerful forces all of your life. But I want to ask you about this moment, because I feel that we are at a peak level of fear and a kind of weaponized fear. And Trump, with his use of Twitter, every day is trying to divide people and make some Americans afraid of other Americans or people who want to come over our borders or overstay a visa at an airport. And the fear of other reached a peak, at least recently, in Trump's mob rallies last year in advance of the midterm elections. And the Washington Post was struggling to keep up with the pace of his lies. At some of those speeches, as much as 70% of what he says is either false or misleading. And it is mostly intended to scare the shit out of people and get mm-hmm. them to look at him as the strong, fearless father who is going to lead us through these various challenges. And I just feel that Americans at some point need to sit up straight, put down the phone, turn off the TV, and just say, I'm not afraid. but we are programmed to submit. We are programmed to become more passive and to just accept this as a kind of new altered reality. How do you respond?
Well, I respond by saying, I don't think that's what most people do want. I think we want to be in community, and this is why I so believe in the buddy system. Anyone listening who feels isolated and afraid, just all you need is one other person who also wants to find that fear doesn't have to be a stop sign. It can be energy that we can use. It can be our pounding heart cheering us on. And, you know, I ended my talk at the commencement at University of San Francisco saying that, you know, most of us don't need to be heroes to the world, but when our day comes, when we You know, the end comes. All we have to feel fulfilled, is to know that we've been heroes to ourselves. And that is really this moment that we're alive is a do or die moment for our country, for the planet. And that, I think, is something we can all achieve, to be heroes to ourselves, if we refuse to stay alone and are willing to risk failure, humiliation, whatever our fear is, embarrassment, you know, to reach out and find even one buddy, and then to connect to the democracy movement in your community and then ultimately the nation. And this democracymovement.us is not live yet, but if you wanted to email us at info@smallplanet.org, we will definitely alert you to its release, and we will have a beta version up if you are interested in giving us feedback. So I think that is the reframe, that instead of mourning that we are alive in this moment, we can say we are called because we are alive in this moment. And we may not be heroes to the world, but we all can be heroes to ourselves.
Frankie, thanks for being a buddy to me and to all of my listeners.
Oh, what a very kind way to express it. I feel exactly that way about you. You know that for a long time now, so it's great.
Frances Moore LePay, thanks for joining me today on the Peter B. Collins Podcast.
My great pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Frances Moore LePay. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.